it's coming through a hole in the air.
You're listening to WGXC Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
Wave Farms WGXC always needs computer donations. If you have one and don't need it, and it's a Macintosh 2019 or newer, please email info@wgxc.org for more information. Thank you for your contribution.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by the Olana Partnership, presenting Third Thursday, a day of tours and programs topped off by Tunes with a View. Visitors can experience global sounds while taking in the views of the Hudson Valley. This month featuring the Afro-Caribbean Brazilian group Heard World on Thursday, August 21st from 12 to 7 p.m. All are welcome. Details at olana.org/thirdthursdays.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Bella Janssens of Brooklyn, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
We'll be right back. Hello, 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 hello. Welcome to Mrs. to the Ether. My name is Kat Tice. That was Promises, Promises by Naked Eyes. It's a remix. You may have noticed it's kind of longer than the original version. It hit my algorithm basically. And, it's a Jelly Bean Benitez remix. For those of you who may not know much about 80s club music, house music, he was a pretty big producer and DJ in the early 80s in New York, notoriously, or maybe sadly most famously known for being one of Madonna's first boyfriends in New York. And I think that this track is kind of having a rebirth just because Madonna's in it, and Madonna's having a moment again. And the story is that he used to put her on tracks like that one to kind of mix her in, get her into the mix, literally. And, it's Leo season, and she's my favorite Leo, so shout out to her. I am so excited for today's show. First of all, this is WGXC Acre live from Catskill. Thank you for listening to listener-supported radio. On the show, you may or may not know, I talk to artists about their creative process and how and where spirit comes into play. And sometimes we read some tarot, which we're going to do today. Today's my guest is Kevin Gotkin, who has been dialed into the disability world since 2012 as an access ecologist, a phrase that we will unpack thoroughly today. Teacher and scholar. They recently worked as an artist organizer with Creative Rebuild New York. Kevin's university-based work includes a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in 2018 and a visiting assistant professorship at NYU. Their performance and curatorial work has been featured at Lincoln Center in various nightlife shenanigans and through their weekly newsletter, Crip News. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm so good. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. We have so much to unpack. Sometimes I have folks on that are like, their relationship to spirit is pretty overt, like they made a tarot deck, or they talk to the dead and they make sculptures about it or whatever. But I'm curious to kind of hear, in knowing you and kind of seeing you in the world and knowing the work that you do, it's clear that spirit is moving you to me. And just kind of identifying as an access ecologist, I think says a lot. But how would you describe your relationship to kind of being in tune with all of this sort of thing?
Yeah. Oh my God. I'm so grateful for this question. I don't get to talk about it, I think, in a lot of professional worlds. You don't really talk about the spiritual stuff, it's kind of, that's personal. But it's in everything that I do. So yeah, I mean, I grew up Catholic, in a pretty conservative town. And so when I realized I was queer and rejected that, it was a long time of being like, no dogma whatsoever, like nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think it probably sent me into academia. I was very much like committed to knowledge is, the only thing we need. But it was a thinness there. I went to grad school immediately after getting my undergrad degree. So I had like no real career except for academia. And so I was in my early 20s and like doing my first kind of professional thing. And I didn't really have much anchoring in anything divine. Queer theory was very divine to me.
Sure.
But I think that's probably part of what made me realize like there is something that I need here. It doesn't need to be Catholicism. It's not just like that's the only thing. And around, yeah, I guess it was honestly queer theory, reading a ton of queer theory. I read...
Munoz?
Yes, of course. Yeah. We were cruising Utopia, honey. We were. and also a lot of queer history, like just touring through a bunch of, you know, grad classes, a lot of different queer communities. One that jumped out at me, I don't even remember where I first read it now, but the name probably did it for me, called the Radical Fairies. Mm. And I was kind of like, funny, that name sounds funny. You know, yeah. They're fairies, but they're radical, you know.
Right.
And then I was living in Philadelphia, and I lived around the corner from the William Way LGBTQ Center. And the Radical Fairies were doing a workshop there on it was a drag workshop.
Of course.
And it was just like how to transform yourself. And it was hilarious. And it was the first time I had done anything like that. Mm. But I also knew that fairies didn't tend to actually gather in cities and organize in cities. That this was a tradition that was very much back to the land and was actually pretty kind of like anti-metro in a way, like the idea that gay and queer life is defined by being in and living and getting to cities. Mm-hmm. This was a movement over the last many decades, but really in the 70s and 80s that moved, you know, out into rural communities and said, this is queer life is here too. And so I started going to gatherings that happen in what are called sanctuaries that are, you know, deep in the gayborhoods of various rural communities. And there's one down in the South that really kind of became my my home. I remember riding up for the first time. And there's this huge barn and there was a sign that said, "Welcome, homo." And I was like, oh, my God, I'm home. And everyone would say, "Welcome home." You know, when you would go around, "Welcome, homo, welcome home." And I was like, whoa. And that community, these folks who have showed me what I think is now my kind of adult spiritual practice, work in a very irreverent tradition, but generally kind of neo-pagan. So holidays of the land, we just had a big one. August 1st was Lammas, the start of the harvest season. Mm. There's a logic that Catholicism never had for me. You know, you plant seeds in your garden in the spring, they grow, you have to harvest it. There was a kind of logic of the land. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, most of us just thinking about climate catastrophe and how we really need to think of the land as living and that we are a part and connected to it. There were things that just fell into place. Mm-hmm. And just realizing maybe I am kind of a witch, you know, spell crafting could be something that's about focus, attention, intention. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that are a little more prosaic that we don't often think of as spiritual when you give it a certain kind of framing. Energy. Exactly. You give it the energy, you take it seriously. That is your practice. And then for me, that just was my research work, my teaching, my artistry. Spirituality is the thing for all of those. It's the thread.
Mm-hmm. So that is a perfect segue to kind of maybe I would love for you to kind of maybe unpack kind of this identification as an access ecologist, because it's so rich.
Yeah,
but I'd love to hear it in your words.
Yeah, well, so yeah, so I that was kind of my queer spiritual personal history I just gave you, but throughout that was also coming to find disability first as an area of study. Mm-hmm. So I was writing a thesis for college. And my advisor was like, you know, for this topic, you should think about disability studies, what those texts might have to say. And I think I probably was like, oh, right. Of course. And I had never heard of disability studies. So mm-hmm. I go and look it up. And that was back in 2010. So it was, it wasn't actually that new then, but it felt very new, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, what is this field? I was kind of looking at it first just to kind of give a spin to a topic of research that I was working on. And then I realized there's something here. And it took me a long time to figure out what I was drawn to about it. Because at first I was this is just a very important area of study. Everything that we think of and think that we know disability, a perspective from disability tends to change it. And I was kind of interested in those radical, like, well, you might think you know the kind of whatever, like anti-capitalist critique of X, but then the disability critique of that takes that even further. And I was like really interested in that. Mm-hmm. And then I think I started realizing actually like disability is very mundane, is very ordinary and very universal. Mm-hmm. And I think I understood that my family and myself, I was working in and living in worlds of disability that we didn't talk about like that, but difficult to diagnose experiences, real limits on what we're able to do. That was like a family vibe. And some of it was like, you know, addiction and like things that feel like psychosocial and trauma and like things that, you know, are a little bit more culture bound or like family bound. Mm-hmm. And then other things that are, yeah, are a little bit more identifiable and this like a medical thing. Mm-hmm. I am not someone that people often identify would be claim the word disabled. And I think I was also kind of mystified around that for a while. Like, why am I so drawn to this area of research? Why am I so down for some of the direct action protests and the histories here? Mm-hmm. And then I realized, like, actually, disability isn't this minority of folks. It often gets thought of that way in political contexts. But disability is really... is the thing that we all encounter, you know, from young age. Maybe the way that we encounter it is with our grandparents or older generations of folks that we need to help take care of. And we're kind of interfacing with them in a medical industrial complex that we all live in, you know, like nursing homes and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I think, far more like ordinary in obviously in queer history, thinking of legacies of HIV and AIDS activism, mental health as like a kind of improper term for all of the different ways that like mental disabilities show up in our lives and in our communities. And I kind of started to realize like, wow, my spiritual practices and who I am as an artist and as a researcher, like disability is there in all of it for me. It's what I can identify the easiest mm-hmm. in any moment. Like it is often the thing that connects us, I think. Mm-hmm. And the kind of methods of working with that immense amount of knowledge and spirit mm-hmm. Is by thinking about accessibility. Mm-hmm. And the way we often think of accessibility is like, is in a form of a checklist, like the Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, has all these things. Are we in compliance? And there's really important histories to the history, you know, there's important histories to those pieces of legislation and anti-discrimination, like standards. That's wonderful. But access is so much more than a checklist. And I think it's taken me a long time to really find my own like philosophical and spiritual basis for thinking of access as the way that we are with each other.
100%.
Like full stop.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm listening to you talk and I keep thinking about disability, visibility, visibility, disability. Like the, you know, what can be seen, what can't be seen, you know, what do we not want to see, you know, what can we acknowledge? Are we acknowledging this because we can't see it, or are we not acknowledging it because we know we're not sure we can take care of it? You know, like it's, I don't know, just like,
oh yeah,
going back big and forth time. In my head, you know,
totally the kind of like, yeah, what's apparent, not apparent, visible, invisible. Like, this is often how disability communities will like kind of make distinctions. Cause there are major distinctions, like someone who uses a wheelchair, right? Like there's an apparent, way of moving through the world. And then there's folks with non-apparent disabilities who are like, you know, it's also really such a bummer to kind of have to use your voice to advocate for something that other folks are not going to be able to anticipate mm-hmm. about the way you might need to access a space and all of the things.
What does it mean to be rejected?
Yep.
If that happens.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so, Yeah, I think, but it's also, it's like a little more mysterious than that, I think, internally too, because ableism is so, so suffused in public life that it's also in our personal lives too. Mm-hmm. Like, folks who are disabled often don't want to identify as disabled because it represents a lack of access to something, you know? Right. And so you'll often hear folks say like, oh, it's like, let's not talk about disability. Let's talk about the ability. And there's a long history to like, even why we have to use this like negation in the category disability. Like, why is it such a hard binary? It kind of goes back to moments when modern medicine needed to prove itself by being able to kind of, you know, have a triumph over a pathological condition. And there, that distinction between what is normal and pathological needed to be very bright line for some of the, you know, power that medical thinking has amassed, and we see it everywhere. But yeah, I used to be kind of like a real militant radical, like Crip, you know, and Crip is a term that like disabled like insiders will use to kind of, you know, get a little, it kind of raises the hackles. It kind of does now still what queer used to do in like 1990. It's like, right. Are we allowed to say that?
Right.
And it's a reclamation project. And I used to be like real, like everyone needs to get in on that. You know, like we all need to identify in this way and let's all like reclaim this. But as I've moved, you know, along and really kind of like understood more about just how powerful ableism is as kind of like a world shaping thing, I really don't blame people who are like, I want to work in my own complex ways that aren't identifying as disabled in every way, you know. And it's sure. often very clear because a lot of folks who are not white are dealing with the layering of inaccessibilities. So it is tends to be a lot of white disabled folks who will say like, let's claim this and let's like move forward together, without realizing that for some folks that adds a level of complexity that truly will end in a dead end. You know, that means no job, no housing, no, like things really are not as easy as just claiming
complex.
That thing. Yeah.
More complex.
So I think, yeah, like the invisible, visible, the different ways of the disability experience are also often have to contend with our own, like where we're at in that matrix and whether we can or don't want to sometimes claim this thing that has such a public life that is often reviled. And, you know, five years on from COVID, we see that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And what's interesting, you know, like you were just saying like, kind of like, oh, like talking about like my relationship to spirit feels so personal. And then, you know, then kind of talking on a larger scale, like what are we allowed personally to say, you know, and what is like kind of like part of our identities that is allowed to kind of come out, and like whether, you know, it makes more sense to be hidden. Like I see some parallels to that, you know what I mean? And I so much, especially, I mean, your work, and I want to think a little bit specifically about kind of your interest in nightlife accessibility, because I think that's a really interesting space and field to kind of like negotiate and study these balances of like the individual and the collective together, and kind of seeing how it's all interrelated and how important it is to kind of understand our own sense of like coming to understanding our spirit to kind of like give that to others, you know? And I see a connection to that in your work.
Big time. Yes. That takes us right to the access ecology, term that I didn't quite, thank you for,
I have my reasons.
Yeah. You're a witch. Witch sees witch here. No, totally. I think so. Yeah. Thinking of access beyond compliance, beyond the checklist, more as something that's like a social fiber, but that we all connect to and latch onto and use as forms of gathering being with each other. It, to me, makes a lot of sense to think of that in ecological terms. So like, yes, there's certain things like ramps, you know, there are grab bars, there's the height of counters, like there's definite design features around the built environment that like can prevent or open up access. But I have been really interested in going like even further, way further. Like, what is a fuller ecological set of factors to think about when we might think of accessibility? Who can be, who can occupy, from what distance, with what kind of power, any kind of space? I feel like there's an ecological analysis you can do. Sure. And so I think, yeah, how I came to nightlife and thinking about access came at a moment when I was doing some like work on cultural policy in New York City. And I was talking with a public official and he was like, you know, so fascinating, like these two groups that really showed out to help us influence this policy were like disabled artists and DIY nightlife organizers. And he was like, isn't that weird? You know, like random. And in my head, I was like, oh, but of course, mm-hmm. you know, but of course, because at that time I was a party girl. I was going out a lot and thinking about accessibility a lot. And it just made sense to me actually that like, these are two communities that kind of do a lot of similar work, you know, retrofitting things, working in an inaccessible space, you know, is kind of what a lot of like underground, like rave organizers and a lot of disability activists are doing. Like it's and yet sometimes, and this is the bummer, a lot of nightlife spaces kind of love the way that their spaces are so inaccessible, you know, that it's kind of unsafe. And there's a lot more to say about that moment also in a policy minded way, because there was like the Ghost Ship fire in Oakland that like took down a lot of radical spaces in the name of like safety. But actually there were very, you know, complex and expansive ways of thinking about safety in DIY venues. So yeah, I think a lot of things kind of pushed me to think like, wow, actually nightlife is a beautiful cauldron for thinking about accessibility, even when it seems like the absolute opposite of that, right. You know?
Well, it's raising the stakes because it's a space where, you know, outside of like kind of just like making a space work that shouldn't work, that's not supposed to work, countering it usually in going back to the city versus country, in cities that are inaccessible, where, you know, young creatives can't, you know, are just trying to figure out how to sustain in a deeply unsustainable space. There's all that going on. And then you throw in like really loud music and people are doing drugs and, you know, and kind of like in like really kind of releasing in ways that's liberatory and beautiful and also kind of creates new forms of precarity.
Yeah.
And then thinking about those who are dealing with visible and non-visible in excess, like inaccessible points, standpoints. Yeah. Like it just makes it really like kind of sticky and interesting, you know?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And I think like a lot of the like traditions of nightlife that we know about, you know, like the spaces where the song that you started the show with would have been played in the 80s, you know, there have been queer traditions of thinking about accessibility that like have truly like influenced our music. You know, they are encoded, they are inscribed on our cultural artifacts, and it's actually really easy to like just listen to it or find it or see, mm-hmm. like, okay, the tea dance, you know, as like a Sunday afternoon, like kind of a more of a daytime nightlife thing. Like that is a form, that's a party form that cannot be explained without understanding the kind of grief and mourning on the dance floor that was happening in the early HIV AIDS crisis.
Right.
So like, it's right there, you know, we are thinking about, how to make space, more available for more people who need to gather,
yeah,
in so many ways over so many forms of nightlife organizing. And now I'm kind of trying to organize, in a new set of ecologies where people are thinking further than that, right? Like, what would it mean to have your access needs met, genuinely met, getting into the venue, being able to choose what you want to do. Like, is that dancing? Is that hanging out? Is that talking? What elixirs? What are like, what forms of intoxication, or another way of thinking, like inducing some kind of ecstatic rapture, you know, like mm-hmm. there's like all kinds of spiritual traditions that can happen in nightlife space. And if we really use access as a matrix mm-hmm. or like a set of spells that we can do together, I think we're really tapping into something very, very powerful that has a beautiful, long, long tradition. And we need to keep asking even more specific and complex questions from that perspective.
Yeah, for sure. You're so dialed into kind of where these conversations are happening. And I feel like, not a lot of people know, like, where do you think this conversation is happening right now? Or, you know, I know that you're about to do work with this project, the Honcho
Camp out. Yes. That's a perfect example. So, in a few days from when we're talking now, I'm leaving for, it's the 10th anniversary of a camp out. It's like a music festival in the woods. It's a queer music festival. It's a space where I have that spiritual connection to the dance floor. It's like where I can be like, look at me doing this choreo in my body that I had no idea was here, because mm-hmm. I am channeling, like I am here with the ghosts, my ancestors, our ancestors here, channeling something divine. Like, and this is like a music festival. It happens every August, and it really does kind of take the form of or it is in the tradition of queer folks gathering in the woods. And that, like I said, with like radical fairy traditions and sanctuary spaces, collectively owned land trusts, there's a whole history to this. And actually, at last year's Honcho Campout, I should say too, Honcho is the name of a DJ collective based in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And they're the folks that organize this, but it's different from their DJ collective and their parties, which are, you know, maybe more conventional, like major cities, and there's, you know, a nightclub and there's a DJ lineup, and they organize and are on programs around the world. Mm-hmm. And then Honcho Campout is this thing that happens for like 4 or 5 days every August in the woods. And last year there was one of my good friends, Dr. Nikita Shepherd, was on a panel talking about like, what's the history of this? Queers in the woods, like there's what's this? And they're a perfect scholar for this. And something that they said on that panel really like blew it open for me, which is that there's all kinds of back to the land movements in the U.S. There's all kinds of queer communities that have worked outside of cities. The most common thing among all of those histories is that queers gather for short periods of time in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my gosh, that's what we're doing here. That's why this like one festival feels like it is activating a whole set of patterns and practices.
It's making me think about birds.
Oh, I mean.
And that's all I'll say about, because I don't know that much about birds, but the minute you're talking about it, I'm just thinking about birds flock together.
Oh, absolutely. And the murmuration, the mm-hmm. kind of like dance floor vibe that you're like, we did not coordinate doing that same thing for the last 5 minutes, and yet here we are. Mm-hmm. Like there's a magnetic thing. Mm-hmm. Like absolutely. Yeah, how we find each other, how we like, you know, thinking about the migratory birds that change, you know, they have to change the mm-hmm. workload up there in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that, you know, sometimes not even because we are deciding to, but because we're feeling it and because we have to keep each other.
But you were talking about
Nikita.
That was a distraction.
It's a perfect example when you're in the woods and you're connecting to these queer, you know, trans and crip histories of gathering together. It's like, that's the kind of creativity that can flow. And I've been really honored for the past, this is my third year, helping, kind of offer to the camp out, to the festival experience, like ways of thinking about access in magical terms.
Mm.
Like, can we all cast a spell together to do something that allows us to do what we want to do? I think the thing that most of us want to do there is like protect each other's sacred access to artistry, to being an artist, to showing up in artful ways as a participant in festival activity. I'm actually getting ready. Each year, the program that I'm on, which is called Best Practices, it's kind of like an orientation program. My friends Nika and Anya curate this incredible program. And each year we have a little gag. And this year, it's the 10th anniversary, so we're like camp counselors throwing like a birthday party for the camp. And I'm going to tell a ghost story.
Yes.
I don't know where I'm going yet. I'm going to have to channel some of it, you know, in order to really tell the story and do this in the way that my spiritual practice, you know, will allow me to. But it's, I try to offer some like actual magical form that people can say, oh my gosh, all I needed to do was like try to identify some of my own access needs.
Yeah.
That, which sometimes, as we were talking about earlier, like it's really easy to just pretend that they're not there, because that's what often getting through an inaccessible world is all about. You're like, I'm fine, girl. But then you go back to your camp and you're like, what if I actually let myself have the things that I'm pretending I don't need? Suddenly you're more available to yourself. You're more available to protect someone else's sacred access to this dance floor. Now we're all channeling at a scale that, oof, you know, that's where I feel my most powerful as a witch. And we're talking just days before I leave to go try to offer another spell to this honcho camp out. So it's a really good example.
I know, that's why I'm shuffling some cards.
Yes.
So I'm going to pass these over to you to shuffle around and you know, you don't have to do it like officially. It's just about getting your energy on the cards. And and you know, I'm transparent about the fact I always talk to the guests about kind of questions we want to think about, before we do the reading on air. And so I know that, you know, kind of the question that you want to ask is sort of kind of connected to kind of preparing for this gathering, kind of thinking collectively about these questions. And, but do you, as you're shuffling, do you want to kind of talk through kind of it more now that we're doing it?
Yes. That we're here in the moment.
No, I've talked around it for a bit.
Totally. No, I mean, it's funny. I'm just so grateful that you like invited me to talk about access magic, because it's a term that I try to use and a lot, you know, and when I do, people are like, what's that? But they ask what's that with this kind of knowing, like, I think I actually kind of know what you mean by that, you know, but like, let's think about it more. And I think there's many reasons why more people might be finding this term to be legible or relevant or something that they want to explore or try to work into or reach for. And you know, we're at a particular moment where, we have full on eugenicist fascist, policies, you know, where disabled folks and folks who need access to high quality healthcare, you know, it's always been a chronic emergency, and now it's like chronic emergency on chronic emergency. Like, I don't even know what you call that. And so we need access magic.
It's a crisis.
It's a crisis. It's a poly crisis. It's like a million things at once. And so access magic to me feels like a natural like outgrowth of these kinds of moments. So I think I'm kind of wondering, as I hold these beautiful cards and try to kind of, put this energy onto them for this reading, like, what's the moment for access magic? Where's it headed? What do we need to keep in mind? What should we know? I think that's...
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I love a to-do list and a tarot question. Just getting closer to the table. Great question. So I always do, I don't think I told you this, Kevin, but I always do a traditional kind of Celtic
cross. Yeah. I know from listening to Missives to the Ether.
Oh, you don't have to show off.
Of course I do. Of course I do. But you're doing access magic. I want to support that.
I love to hear it. Sorry, guys. I'm doing a new mic setup so I can do this all at the same time and be on the mic, but there's some shifts. Okay. So, I love... Okay, we got the Empress and the Three of Swords crossed over, and this is... I think of this the center as like kind of the protagonist. So, that's you, girl. You're the Empress.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
She's stunning, right?
Stunning.
Love that. Crossed over with... so very powerful. I mean, like, the Empress is the Empress. She's super powerful. Fully in her power, and I think that obviously kind of connects to kind of like what the end goal is, not just for ourselves but for everyone. And it's just like, you know, thinking, listening to you talk about access magic to me, and like my feeling about why I think people are intrigued or curious about it is, especially in this moment of like really, really deep uncertainty, is, you know, kind of realizing, or, you know, kind of, there's something kind of unlatching where it's like realizing that if we can't proactively hear and kind of accommodate others' needs, we will not be accommodated when we are in need. And obviously this logic should just exist, but, you know, living under capitalism, like, it's so, I mean, it's a system that actively disconnects us from like that just access point within ourselves.
Yes.
And so for me, my understanding of how I'm coming to this concept of access magic is realizing that kind of leaning into kind of aid is a way to kind of heal, yes, the fear and kind of uncertainty within ourselves the moment, you know?
Yes, yes.
So all that is to say, as I'm interpreting the middle point of the spread, which I haven't completely uncovered yet, is the Empress is crossed with the Three of Swords, which is heartbreak.
Ouch.
But it makes sense, because it's like we are, you know, whether we like it or not, we are going to experience trauma. We're going to experience mm-hmm. grief. We're going to experience mm-hmm. uncertainty. Like, these are givens. No, you know, we whether it's we're born with it or it comes upon us or we just age, like, we will kind of lose our abilities to be fully abled. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just a reality. Yeah. And while that's happening, we're witnessing the people we care about also going through the same chain of events, and how to be prepared for that, and how not to be avoidant of that. So, for me, this crossing makes a lot of sense. Of like, this is like the moment of like just it's not even like this is the moment. This is the reality, and we have to just look at the reality.
Hugely, and also like on this gorgeous deck that you have, the Empress is depicted as quite cozy, like on these beautiful pillows on this throne, and then the swords are of course pointy, not cozy, and
stabbed in someone's heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm just turning over the rest just to see what we got to working with here. Okay, so above and a below. So the below, we have the moon upright, and above we have the Queen of Wands upturned. I'm going to start with, so the below, I interpret that this is kind of the internal workings, kind of what is not seen. And then above is sort of like kind of like how it may be true of like what we, how people are, or how others, let's not limit to just people, but how others, how the world like is perceiving us. And it may be true, maybe not, you know, we all are kind of performing in one way or another. Cause you know, we can't let it all hang out all the time, you know, but you know, what's happening internally guides us. So the moon kind of being the internal reflection makes a lot of sense to me, because it's all about just kind of like wilding out, like being in touch with your wildest self. So this feels really literal in regards to your work, because it's all about kind of relinquishing like full spirit, authentic self, like queer as self, you know.
I mean, it really looks like a depiction of Honcho Camp Out. Honestly, there's femme bodies under the moonlight, naked with masks on. And there's like a creature coming out of a body of water with like beady red eyes. And it's like feral. But it also seems highly ritualistic and night. I mean, it's nightlife. It is nightlife.
Yeah. And then there's like this murky black figure in the water kind of creeping out just to kind of keep it interesting, you know, like, but also like the darkness and, you know, the moon for me also represents kind of being in touch with the shadow self, you know, and I think, you know, nightlife, we're talking about nightlife in such a large umbrella way, but I think you know what I mean. I think listeners know what I mean, but you know, it's like, it's a place where kind of like our, you know, our shadow selves can be free and kind of be celebrated too. But also going back to what I was saying earlier about the stakes are higher in that space for a lot of reasons, like that's also the fine line, you know? So I think it's interesting that this showed up here. Yeah, so Queen of Wands reversed, it's important to name the reversal, I think, it's all about kind of being, usually like being confronted with a maternal figure. But I think the external forces are just like resistance to, status quo. It feels like kind of internalized. Like I think, you know, not to take gender out of it, but I think, you know, kind of thinking about kind of a particular kind of like maternal oppression is like kind of like, you know, there are systems of care in place that are working just fine. Why trouble it? Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the potentially some external projection or perception of kind of what is being thrown down or being kind of processed.
And this is in the above or like external placement.
Yeah. This
reading.
Right here.
Yep.
Yeah. When she's upturned, she can be pretty understanding, but also, you know, it's not like kind of like, a deep, like, you know, like real, like when we think about kind of like oppressors, we're not thinking about the folks that are like, want to take away all the funding and let people just die in the streets. This resistance is more of like, we just want to kind of maintain what we had, whatever little it was, like, you know, kind of, it's almost like kind of fear of like kind of tearing everything down. I'll go ahead a little bit saying, so in our kind of the to-do list fourth part of the spread, we do have a tower in reversal, which is all about kind of letting it all fall apart. So I think, you know, kind of just like taking like a full view lens of this spread for a second, I think the real tension around this issue or one tension that could potentially be showing itself is just like, the feeling that we have to tear it all apart to kind of rebuild, and other figures within the conversation are just like, I think it's best to just fight for like what we've already established in whatever the system was to kind of, so at least we have something. So I think that's going to be really the internal dialogue. Does that have any resonance for you?
Well, fully, fully, because, you know, the distinction, not just in disability worlds, many like rights versus justice is often about institutions and about like the tower, that thing that has been built that is often in crisis. And so that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And that's what position is that? Like this is, you said the to-do list. There's like a stack of,
the way I read kind of this side is like, I think of it as kind of like a whole phrase. Like there's not like kind of like a plan of action, but I think this is like kind of going off of the future presence, which I kind of skipped ahead, but I tend to do that when I read. But like, this is like sort of the future present, which is good. It's about getting back to work, but we'll get to that. And then it kind of like energetically, this is kind of the framework of how it's all going to feel. But going back really fast, so we have the past card, which is a Knight of Cups in reversal. Knight of Cups in reversal means actions not taken.
Wow.
And so I think kind of connected to this reversal, Queen of Wands. And I, you know, I would argue and dare to say that, like, I think in kind of the larger question of like what we have to face in kind of confronting kind of like what's going on politically, there is a lot of kind of internal tensions, not just within this world, but in many different communities and worlds and conversations and movements where the resistance is internal and intergenerational, and that where kind of markers of where things needed to be addressed, but were kind of, I don't know, covered up with like a Band-Aid as opposed to kind of like a real conversation, have like kind of been exacerbated to like, you know, the crisis mode that we're in and seeing in so many different ways. And so I see this kind of counterbalance of the Knight of Cups and the Queen of Wands resisting as being like, can't we just go back to Band-Aids? And like, there's another movie, like the Band-Aids are gone. We're out, you know, like, so it's like, this is like the vibe.
Wow. 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 Wow.
Is that, yeah, it makes sense.
For sure. I mean, yeah, it just kind of connects right to what we were saying earlier. I think like a lot of movement organizing is so close to us.
Yeah.
It's so close to our lives that there's a lot of ouchies and then there's a lot of Band-Aids, you know?
So many ouchies. Okay. I'm going to plow through the last part because we're almost at time. So Eight of Pentacles is our future present, and it's all about just kind of getting to work. Pentacles is represents kind of money, but it's also kind of laborious. We didn't really touch upon your work, but you do, and I think it also interconnects, like thinking about kind of creating kind of like making like finances accessible to artists. Yeah. And I'll just have to have you back so we can just talk about that sometime.
Guaranteed income for artists. That's what this card is about.
Yeah. Well, that, and also just kind of, but also kind of just staying in, you know, I think now is the time to really kind of just like think about work, it's like really about getting to work, kind of think about how to get the resources to who needs it. And that's like, should be the priority. It's like, kind of like, you know, theoretical debates, the time is over. Like now we just have to get to work. You know, and kind of like, and, you know, think outside of institutions, like, you know, not expect institutions to kind of come up with a solution they never have outside of kind of like taking care of themselves. So it's like, you know, it's really just like, kind of like, let's just create our new systems. Let's just do our own projects. Let's like kind of create our own networks, like, do all of that. So then the lineup is like Tower in reverse, Queen of Cups in reverse, Five of Swords, Ace of Pentacles. It landing on the Ace of Pentacles is really good. I think that that's all about kind of seeing the fruits of your labors. With that said, there's going to be some drama. Five of Swords is all about kind of like, sometimes you don't want to fight, but you got to fight. And it's I think the key thing here is kind of like knowing when to pick your battles, realizing that sometimes the battles will come and like your intentions are misinterpreted. And I say yours, I'm not saying it personally. I'm saying it as like, kind of like, I think kind of like as a movement that toes are being stepped on. I don't even think it's like kind of in the future. I just sense that toes are being stepped on. Feelings are getting hurt. The Queen of Cups rules in feelings. In reversal, it's like a little bit of like kind of like get over yourself a little bit and just kind of like think about the end goal. And also, I think kind of the message I'm getting is like thinking about understanding that when one feels or it feels like personal, it's because it is. And also being able to kind of like utilize and kind of understand the kind of the cycle of like an access magic concept to understand that to cycle and that the feelings of like kind of like offense is really because there's some work to do within to kind of get over it, to kind of keep on moving forward.
Wow. Read me, drag me. No, I mean, and not me, as this is a question of
I'm dragging us.
Exactly. Like the feeling. Yes. Wow.
So, we're already at time. This show goes by too fast. I'm going to make it, we're working on this, but, for now, we have to wrap up. Kevin, you have to come back. We've barely scratched the surface. But how can folks, you have an amazing Substack called Crypt News. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about like what is on there before we wrap up?
Yeah, totally. Thank you. It's a weekly newsletter, kind of dialing us all into disability politics and culture. Features a lot of new works by disabled artists.